Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUSCast, Sports Betting Prohibitions and State Commandeering Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On May 15, 2018, the Supreme Court decided Murphy v. NCAA, a case involving a conflict between state-authorized sports gambling and a federal statute, the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992, PASPA. PASPA prohibits state-sanctioned gambling with respect to amateur and professional sporting events. Among other things, the statute allows sports leagues whose events are the subject of betting schemes to bring an action to enjoin any gambling. PASPA did accept certain states from its prohibitions, including New Jersey, but only if New Jersey established its sports gambling scheme within 1 year of PASPA's enactment. New Jersey did not do so, and in fact prohibited sports gambling until a 2011 referendum amended the state constitution to allow it. Thereafter, New Jersey enacted the 2012 Sports Wagering Act, which created a government-regulated sports betting scheme. Invoking PASPA, five sports leagues sued to enjoin the 2012 law. New Jersey countered that PASPA was unconstitutional under the federal anti-commandeering doctrine. The district court deemed PASPA constitutional and enjoined the implementation of the wagering law. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit affirmed, and the U.S. Supreme Court denied certiorari. In 2014, New Jersey enacted a new gambling law which repealed certain restrictions on, quote, the placements and acceptance of wagers, end quote, on sporting events so long as those events did not involve New Jersey collegiate teams or other in-state collegiate sporting events. New Jersey contended that this law was admissible under PASPA because it did not actively authorize sports betting. Once again, sports leagues sued to enjoin the law as a violation of PASPA and prevailed in federal district court. The Third Circuit, sitting in bank, again affirmed, holding that PASPA did not commandeer New Jersey in a way that ran afoul of the federal constitution. The Supreme Court granted certiorari to address whether a federal statute that prohibits modification or repeal of state law prohibitions on private conduct impermissibly commandeers the regulatory power of the states. By a vote of 6-3, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Third Circuit. In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito, the court held that the provisions of PASPA that prohibit state authorization and licensing of sports gambling schemes violate the Constitution's anti-commandeering rule and cannot be severed from the remainder of the statute, which collapses as a result. Justice Alito's majority opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy, Thomas, Kagan, and Gorsuch. Justice Breyer joined all except as to Part 6B. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion. Justice Breyer filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justice Sotomayor joined, and in which Justice Breyer joined in part. And now, to discuss the case, we have Albert Lin, partner at Hunton & Williams.
So, big decision, both for sports gambling and more broadly from a constitutional perspective. But to set the table, let me talk a little bit about the facts of the case and some of the history, because I think that's helpful, and then I'll walk through the opinions. So the issue is the constitutionality of PASPA, the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992. There's two provisions in particular that are discussed in the opinion. One is 37022, and that prohibits states from authorizing, licensing, sponsoring, operating, advertising, promoting sports wagering, not necessarily in that order, I'm paraphrasing. And then 37022, which prohibits private individuals from doing a lot of those same things, quote, pursuant to state law. The issue here is that about 6 years ago, New Jersey decided that notwithstanding PASPA, which again prohibits states from operating, advertising, or promoting sports wagering, it was going to change its existing prohibitions on sports wagering and enact what it itself has described as sort of a Nevada-style licensing regime for sports wagering. That law was challenged by the various professional sports leagues and the NCAA. New Jersey lost in the Third Circuit in a split opinion. And then they sought cert, and cert was denied. Notably, when the United States opposed cert in that first round of litigation, the solicitor's office said that PASPA doesn't stop states just from repealing existing prohibitions in whole or in part. So that being arguably different from enacting a regime that actually licensed sports wagering pursuant to state law. So New Jersey went back to the drawing board and, taking a cue from that and from some language in the Third Circuit opinion, decided, okay, we won't enact Nevada-style licensing regime, but we will just repeal the existing prohibitions in part. And it was in part because they repealed it with respect to certain places where gambling is otherwise licensed, so casinos and racetracks. They lost in the Third Circuit again and then sought cert, and this time the Supreme Court granted cert, and granted cert over the objection of the United States, which the Solicitor General had been invited to express his views. Aside from the sort of constitutional ramifications, it was kind of a neat case because you had Ted Olson on one side representing New Jersey and Paul Clement on the other representing the sports leagues and NCAA. In the interest of full disclosure, I represented West Virginia when I was the solicitor, starting in the first case and then through the second case up until I left the office last fall. And so I didn't actually file the merits amicus, and that merits amicus was filed on behalf of West Virginia and a bunch of other states. Well, then I attended argument in December, and it was pretty clear, at least to me, after the argument that New Jersey was going to win. The question was sort of on what grounds, and there is a constitutional question and a statutory question, and I'll get into both of them when I talk about the opinion. And it wasn't totally clear to me whether there were enough votes on the constitutional grounds. It turns out that there are, and there were. And I had thought it was going to be 6-3 with the five conservatives and Justice Breyer. It turned out to be 7-2 with Alito writing and Kagan also joining the majority. So let's talk about the decisions. Like I said, the majority was written by Justice Alito. It was 7-2 with Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, Kennedy, Kagan joining in full, and then Breyer joining everything but the part on severability. He then wrote his own partial concurrence. Justice Thomas joined in full, but also concurred on the question of severability. And then Justice Ginsburg wrote a dissent, joined in full by Justice Sotomayor and joined in part by Justice Breyer, also on the question of severability. And that dissent by Ginsburg doesn't really get into what they thought on the merits, but we'll talk about that when we get to the separate opinions. So in the majority opinion, the first question that they had to decide, and this is something I alluded to a little bit earlier, was this question of statutory interpretation. And that's because, as I said, the statute in question prohibits states from authorizing and licensing, and those are the two key terms, as well as a bunch of other stuff, sports wagering. And there was a threshold statutory interpretation question on what does authorizing mean. The petitioners, New Jersey and then Governor Christie, had argued that authorizing has a fairly broad meaning, and it includes the repeal of existing prohibitions, because by taking away an existing prohibition in the law, you are permitting, you know, that activity to occur and therefore authorizing it. The United States and the respondents, the sports leagues, argued for a narrower construction of authorization, which would have avoided the constitutional question, and said, you know, authorizing is not so broad as to include simply permitting an activity to occur, but it actually has to be something more like affirmatively granting permission to do something. And so that seems to me to be something closer to licensing, but that was their argument. And that would have avoided, in their view, having to delve into the anti-commandeering constitutional question that sort of was ultimately at issue here. The majority didn't buy it. The Supreme Court said you have to look at the meaning of the word authorization against the backdrop of, you know, what the state of regulatory affairs was. And in this case, you've got 40-plus states that, as a result of PASPA, have these state prohibitions in place on sports wagering. And so when they repeal those prohibitions, that is authorizing. So authorizing has a broader meaning that includes simply permitting when you've got the status quo as a prohibition of the activity at issue. And the Alito draws a comparison to situations where there is no pre-existing regulatory scheme, like there's no prohibition on, you know, brushing your teeth. The fact that they don't regulate brushing your teeth doesn't mean that they're authorizing that. But that's because there was no pre-existing backdrop of regulation. The majority's conclusion is, look, you know, as a matter of statutory interpretation, authorizing includes the partial repeal that occurred here. And so we need to get into the constitutional question, which is whether that violates the anti-commandeering doctrine. There's an interesting part to the opinion here where the majority very quickly dispenses with the argument of constitutional avoidance. And that's, as those who follow these issues know, that's an oft-debated and somewhat controversial doctrine in terms of how it's applied. And they dispense with it very quickly, just saying, you know, in essence, that to apply the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, there has to be a plausible alternative reading that could avoid the constitutional question. And Alito says that the reading here being advanced by the respondents and the United States, you know, in terms of what authorizing might could be read to mean, is of debatable plausibility. And so they move on. So then we get into the constitutional stuff. And there's sort of two important rulings here. One is on the anti-commandeering doctrine, and the other is on what federal preemption means. And this case is sort of always turned on, you know, where is that line between anti-commandeering, which is the federal government unlawfully telling states what to do, and preemption, where the federal government has done something in the space with federal law, and that federal law takes precedence over state law. So on anti-commandeering, this is the third Supreme Court case to strike down a law under the anti-commandeering doctrine. The first two are New York versus United States and Prince versus United States. And the opinion is helpful in providing some further articulation on the anti-commandeering theory. Justice Alito talks for a little bit about, you know, what are the origins of the anti-commandeering theory and sort of what does it really mean? And there's a quote from the opinion that I have here where he says, "Conspicuously absent from the list of powers given to Congress is the power to issue direct orders to the government of states. The anti-commandeering doctrine simply represents the recognition of this limit on congressional authority." And that's kind of his, you know, and now seven justices, his sort of pithy summary of what the anti-commandeering doctrine means. It's not within the enumerated powers of Congress to, you know, basically tell a state what to do. And then Alito surveys a couple reasons why anti-commandeering is important. He highlights three. The first is the vertical separation of powers between the federal government and the state governments. It protects liberty. And that's sort of a very hot argument today as you see more and more state attorneys general suing the federal government, something that occurred under the Obama administration and is happening even more under the Trump administration. The second argument as to why anti-commandeering is important is political accountability. That's an argument that we stressed in the state amicus briefs throughout the life of this case. And that's the idea that if the federal government is allowed to tell states what to do and to enact federal policy through the states as opposed to through federal law, you blur the lines of accountability between state officials and federal officials. And then the third reason that Alito highlighted as to why anti-commandeering is important is that it prevents Congress from shifting costs for federal priorities and federal policies to the states. And ultimately, after sort of walking through the anti-commandeering doctrine and I think kind of reaffirming it and maybe giving a clearer articulation of where at least the current court thinks it finds, that doctrine finds its constitutional roots, they get to the heart of the issue here, which is, you know, is there a difference between what happened in New York versus the United States and Prince versus the United States, which were cases where Congress directed the states to enact certain policies and sort of affirmatively do certain things. Is there a difference between that and what happened here, which is a prohibition on states, as has been put in some of the briefing, a negative command? It prohibits states from taking certain actions. It bars them from enacting new laws, or perhaps repealing, as happened here, repealing existing laws. And the majority rejects that distinction between an affirmative command and a negative command and says that, you know, what happened in New York and Prince, although those were affirmative commands, was just a matter of happenstance, that there's really no distinction between the two. And then Alito writes, quote, "It is as if federal officers were installed in state legislative chambers and were armed with the authority to stop legislators from voting on any offending proposals. A more direct affront to state sovereignty is not easy to imagine." So the big anti-commandeering ruling here is that seven members of the court reject outright that there's really any distinction between an affirmative command and a negative command. And then that leads into preemption. And one of the defenses that had been offered by the other side in the United States is, no, this is not anti-commandeering, this is just preemption, because, you know, the federal government has the ability to preempt state law, and that's really all they're doing here. The federal government has simply said that states can't do certain things in this space where we, the federal government, otherwise have the constitutional power to act pursuant to the Commerce Clause. Alito and the majority say that's based on an incorrect understanding of preemption. Preemption is not, and he says, quote, an independent grant of legislative power. It is just a rule of decision that prioritizes constitutionally enacted federal law over conflicting state law. So what you've got to have, and this is an argument that Ted Olson stressed, that argument, something, again, that we put in our amicus briefs, you've got to have an underlying federal regime, a federal law that, as the majority puts it, imposes restrictions or confers rights on private actors. And what preemption under the Supremacy Clause does is it says if you've got state laws that conflict with those restrictions or those rights imposed by federal law on private actors, and that federal law is constitutional, then conflicting state laws must give way. And that's all that preemption under the Supremacy Clause is. It is not a power to affirmatively stop states from enacting new laws or repealing their existing laws. It's simply a rule of decision that says, you know, which law takes precedence. And there's a sort of an important discussion in this section on express preemption clauses, because that's really where the rubber met the road on this, where the United States and respondents pointed to, you know, express preemption clauses, which those on the call are probably familiar with, clauses that say, you know, no state shall enact or enforce XYZ kind of law. And what Alito says is, those kinds of preemption clauses, quote, might appear to operate directly on the states, but it is a mistake to be confused by the way in which a preemption provision is phrased. And he goes on to say, what those provisions is doing is often obscured by the language used by Congress in framing preemption provisions. Even though those appear to say things like, you know, no state shall do the following, shall enact these kinds of laws, those are not provisions that are sort of freewheeling prohibitions on state legislators. What they are doing is they are simply expressing the sort of the priority preference, right? And they're always part of federal laws that have, you know, again, as he says, that impose restrictions or confer rights on private actors and not simply on states. And what those express preemption clauses are doing is they're saying, you know, if you've got state laws that are in conflict, they must give way. And so there's sort of the key holding here then, you know, to apply that to this case is that he says PASPA does not make sports gambling a federal crime for private actors. And in particular, the provision that was challenged, which is 37021, does not apply to private actors. Now, there's a really interesting nugget in the preemption discussion, because as we talk about the larger federalism implications of this case, one of the things that people are going to think about is the latest battles between the federal government and the state governments, and in particular with respect to immigration. When Alito is talking about preemption, he gives an example, and there's lots of examples he could have picked out of cases where the court has decided preemption provisions before. But in the context of field preemption, he picks out Arizona versus United States, which is a relatively recent opinion that addressed an Arizona law that sought to basically give local law enforcement more authority over enforcing immigration laws. And he talks about in there that there's a part of the opinion that talks about federal preemption and the federal registration scheme for aliens in the United States and how that confers not just, you know, what requirements there are for registering with the federal government, but also a federal right to be free from any other registration requirements. You know, there's maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I do find it interesting that of all the examples that the court picked out, they picked out an immigration example for preemption. And then the last part of the constitutional ruling that I thought was interesting was the court addresses whether there's any difference between authorizing and licensing under the statute, and they basically say that there isn't, that the prohibition on licensing is just as constitutionally offensive as the prohibition on states authorizing sports gambling. And this is an interesting point to me, just having lived through the history of this case, because, you know, one of the distinctions between the first round of the case and the second round, if you remember what I said before, was the sort of Nevada-style licensing regime versus just a straight repeal of the existing prohibitions. And the court obliterates any suggestion that there's any less constitutional infirmity in the statute in either circumstance. So, you know, though they didn't grant cert the first time around, I mean, this opinion, you know, goes as far as it would have needed to have gone to strike down the statute the first time around. And so then they get into the severability, which is where all the action is between the justices. And Alito walks through basically three parts of the severability analysis and asks sort of the familiar question, you know, what would Congress think of, you know, this part of the statute being struck down? And would it want the rest of the provisions to go forward? And he addresses first the rest of 37021, which is the remaining provisions on prohibitions on what states can do. So not just authorizing and licensing, but also promoting, operating, sponsoring, and just those three. Then there's also advertising, which he takes separately. And he says, you know, if Congress had known that states would be free to authorize sports gambling in privately owned casinos by the court now striking down the limitation on authorizing and licensing, would it have nevertheless wanted to prevent states from running sports lotteries themselves? So that gets to the sponsoring and operating. And Alito concludes for the majority that that seems exactly backwards. And so says, you know, Congress wouldn't have wanted those other prohibitions to continue forward and strikes those down, says they are not severable. He then addresses 37022, which is the part of PASPA that applies to private actors, and says that prohibition on private actors and the prohibition on the states were two schemes meant to work together, and that just leaving the prohibition on private conduct in place would not implement, quote, a coherent federal policy. And what he points out is that if you left that in place, what you would have is the states could authorize sports gambling, could license sports gambling, but then 37022 would make it illegal under federal law for private individuals to do something that the states were permitting and authorizing and licensing as a matter of state law. And he says, quote, if the people of a state support the legalization of sports gambling, federal law would make the activity illegal. We do not think that Congress ever contemplated such a weird result. And then the last part is he goes into advertising and sort of goes through that very quickly and says it's not often that Congress has prohibited advertising of lawful activity. He talks about tobacco as an exception to that general rule and basically concludes that because it's something that they're not likely to do, haven't done very often, doesn't seem like they would want to do it here. There are, as I said, three separate opinions. Justice Thomas joins the majority in full, but then has a concurrence where he basically questions modern severability doctrine jurisprudence and says that it seems to be in tension with traditional limits on judicial authority that has limited courts deciding individual cases for individual parties. There's a lot of interesting academic writing on that, and you know, he invites future litigants to raise questions about, you know, what the court's severability jurisprudence should look like, if there should even be severability jurisprudence. Justice Breyer, as I said, joined everything in the majority opinion but the severability analysis. He says that 37022, which is the provision that applies to private actors, should be severable. And he argues that Congress could have seen that as a basically a backup plan, that if 37021, the prohibitions on states, was struck down as unconstitutional, as is happening in this case, Congress would have wanted the private party restrictions to go forward. And he acknowledges that if that were the case, this would be a Pyrrhic victory for New Jersey, but, you know, maybe that's what Congress intended. And then Ginsburg, joined by Justice Sotomayor, would have gone even further, would have said that basically, everything is severable from the authorizing and licensing prohibitions. Doesn't really weigh in on what she thinks of the majority's constitutional holdings with respect to those two parts of 37021, but says that essentially, and I'm sort of really simplifying, but that the court has kind of applied the wrong presumption in terms of severability. And she points out that generally speaking with severability, they sort of work from the perspective of trying to save the statute and not trying to destroy it. She, you know, essentially reasons that the majority here is kind of approaching it from the wrong perspective.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.